are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, Candy One, Candy One. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Blake and Ulick, PA, and Bricklayers and Allied Craftsworkers Local 15. Blake and Ulick, advocates for labor for over 40 years, proudly representing organized labor and its members throughout Missouri and Kansas. And Bricklayers and Allied Craftsworkers Local 15, in unity there is strength, please support workers' rights. Back Local 15, Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska. And we thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that cutting state university budgets is bad for faculty, staff, and students. But this week on the show, we have a rocket scientist to tell us just that and to give us a simple answer on how to stop gutting our universities. Then, Kansas City AFL-CIO President Pat Dukjakovic will explain why a proposed forced arbitration law for employees in the Missouri legislature means surrendering our rights. And if that's not enough, he'll discuss how the so-called right-to-work law also shrinks workers' rights. In the news, it's International Working Women's Day, formerly known as Working Women's Day. Today, they just call it Women's Day. We'll talk about why. And Missouri, soon to be and Missouri's soon-to-be new gun laws. Hooray, guns everywhere. Now for the news.
It's International Women's Day, and the best way to celebrate it is with a strike. Back in 1909, the inspiration for Working Women's Day came from the rising of the 20,000, the great strike of women sweatshop workers in New York City, which won union contracts in dozens of shops. Last week on this show, you heard about a play, which opens next week, about the tragic fire in one shop that refused to let its workers organize, Triangle Shirtwaist Company. There, 2 years after the 1909 strike, 147 women workers perished. And today, millions of women workers around the world still face the same dangerous conditions. They need unions and possibly strikes, too. So it is with great joy that women and men today can celebrate the victory of the West Virginia teachers this week against a state that so undervalued their labor that a majority had to take second and third jobs, and one even panhandled for money on the street for school supplies for her students. Their 9-day strike has inspired teachers around the country. Teachers in Oklahoma, which is 50th in pay in the country, have issued a strike threat. And yesterday, Arizona teachers and supporters flooded social media with photos wearing red to school in protest of what many described as the state's lethargic response to a teacher crisis that has driven thousands of qualified teachers out of the classroom. A group of Arizona teachers spontaneously organized the #RedForEd grassroots effort, which has spurred talks on social media of a possible strike over the weekend. In West Virginia, Adina Barnett, the 36-year-old president of Jackson County Education, told Mike Elk of The Guardian she hoped the teachers' success would help restore West Virginia's place in America's labor history. The state was once one of the strongholds of organized labor. On Tuesday, Governor Jim Justice passed a law granting all public employees, not just teachers, a 5% across-the-board raise. The teachers stood up for all public employees with their demands. But where the money will come from is another question. The governor says the rumor that they will cut Medicaid is false. but he had no comment on raising taxes on fracking companies, as the union and its allies preferred.
PAI reports that Labor Secretary Alex Acosta admitted that the Labor Department did not survey the quantitative impact of letting bosses appropriate workers' tips before rescinding the Obama administration rule designed to prevent such wage theft. Despite that, he declared to Congress that he won't reinstate the ban on tip theft. His new rule, say congressional Democrats, will harm low-wage workers, especially working women. The pro-tip theft rule is also a key cause of the anti-worker National Restaurant Association. Acosta said DOL did a qualitative survey on tip theft, but he won't release it. While DOL didn't run the numbers on the tip theft, the Economic Policy Institute, using federal data, did in mid-January. It reported that if Trump's rule takes effect, the average tipped worker could lose a minimum of $1,000 yearly, and tipped workers are among those who can least afford such losses. In total, tipped workers would lose between $5.8 billion and $13 billion a year due to employers pocketing their tips. 80% of the losses would be to working women. On its surface, the new rule allows for tip pooling, which makes it sound like tips will be shared with the back-of-the-house employees like dishwashers and cooks. But Acosta's replacement rule does not require employers to distribute the tips, so employers would be no more likely to share tips with back-of-the-house workers than they would be to make any other choice about what to do with a business windfall, EPI commented. In response, House Democrat Representatives Catherine Clark of Massachusetts and Rosa DeLauro of Connecticut introduced the Tip Income Protection Act yesterday that would amend the Fair Labor Standards Act to make all tips, even the ones that are pooled, the property of the employee, not the employer.
There's a new organization called Seniors for Justice that's based at John Knox Village. They've joined Missouri Jobs with Justice, and at Tuesday's meeting, they shared an article called Ageism is Real and Missourians Pay a Heavy Price by Daniel Rexroth, president and CEO of John Knox Village. His commentary was published in the Kansas City Star in February. He asserts that Missouri is neglecting Medicaid recipients by refusing to provide adequate reimbursement for care and services for the state's oldest citizens at nursing centers. This puts future care at risk. He stated that Missouri sets its Medicaid rate at just $15.26 per day for each resident who receives skilled nursing care. This amount isn't enough to provide an average care. By contrast, Missouri's neighboring states pay long-term care facilities an average of $48.22 per day, a rate that is more than three times the amount Missouri pays. By comparison, he says, Missouri pays $60 a day per inmate to take care of prisoners. Shouldn't seniors at least receive the same amount of support from the state as criminals, he asks? Rexroth is asking people to contact their state representatives to fix Medicaid funding and quit using it to solve the state's funding challenges.
Missouri State Rep. Judy Morgan sent out a report on the new slew of gun bills in the Missouri legislature, which were heard last week after the Parkland, Florida school shooting. The hearing room was packed and overflowing into the hallways. Eight bills were heard, four from each party. Here's a short summary of each bill. The four Democrat bills would first authorize an individual income tax deduction of up to $150 per taxpayer for the cost of up to 8 hours of firearms education and training courses or firearm safety courses. The second bill prohibits a person from transferring any firearm, ammunition, or accessory to someone under 18. The third allows only licensed firearms dealers to sell guns, thus eliminating sales at gun shows. The fourth repeals part of the Stand Your Ground and the Concealed Carry Law. The Republican bills are a bit different. The first one preempts local government from regulating open carry, so only the state would be able to do that. The second permits lawful gun owners to transport or store their guns in locked, privately owned vehicles in parking garages, lots, and parking places, even if the property owner doesn't want guns on his property. The third prohibits use of any kind of firearm tracking technology. And finally, in a bill which Morgan calls the Guns Everywhere Law, it would allow individuals to conceal and carry guns into many places in which they are now outlawed, including any public college campus, public schools by designated teachers and administrators, bars, city buses, but no bombs, please, churches, election precincts where you vote, child care facilities, casinos, hospitals, zoos, and amusement parks. All the Republican bills were voted out of committee positively, and three of the Democrat bills were rejected by party line votes. The committee did unanimously approve the bill for a tax deduction for firearms training. That's the news from our side. The news was read by Kip Niven of SAG-AFTRA, Jen Zaman, and I'm Judy Ansel.
When I was a little girl, I wished I was a boy. I tagged along behind the gang and wore me corduroys. Everybody said I only did it to annoy, but I was gonna be an engineer. Mama told me, can't you be a lady? Your duty is to make me the mother of a pearl. Wait until you're older, dear, and maybe you'll be glad that you're a girl. Dainty as a Dresden statue, gentle as a Jersey cow, smooth as silk, gives creamy milk, learn to coo, learn to moo, that's what you do to be a lady now. When I went to school, I learned to write and how to read some history, geography, and home economy. And typing is a skill that every girl is sure to need to while away the extra time until the time to breed. Then they had the nerve to say, what would you like to be? I says, I'm gonna be an engineer. No, you only need to learn to be a lady. The duty isn't yours for to try and run the world. An engineer could never have a baby. Remember, dear, that you're a girl. She's smart for a woman. I wonder how she got that way.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Heartland Labor Forum. This is Jacob White. Joining me in studio tonight from Lawrence, Kansas, is Professor Ron Barrett Gonzalez. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's a thrill to be back in my hometown of Kansas City.
It's great to have you back, and we were talking about how the barbecue is better here than
it is up there
in Lawrence.
So. I dare not speak too loudly, but Gates, Arthur Bryant, they're all great. They're all great.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you back, and we had you on the show a little while ago. It's been a little, and I think it's fair to say that a lot has happened at KU since then.
Yeah.
And I think we'll focus mostly on this past semester. A lot has happened. Was it the first semester that with the new gun laws?
Yeah, it's the first semester, and you know, within a month or two, we had a record number of shootings in Lawrence. You know, it's when Jimmy Kimmel broke down on national TV. You know, the idea is whenever you introduce more guns into a particular subset of society, you're going to end up with more troubles. We're lucky we haven't seen more violence on the KU campus, but we have seen some. We had a graduate teaching assistant who was threatened with a weapon on campus. I was threatened with being shot in my class by a student, an F-level student. So it's been scary.
Wow. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about how that, you know, working under fear like that could impact how you grade and also it must be hard to function as a regular classroom under those conditions.
Oh, it's debilitating, especially because a lot of things like mental health records and grades, they're protected by FERPA and HIPAA, so you can't let the other students in the class know by federal law, and yet they're very much under danger or in danger from a potential student becoming unhinged. And you don't know whether or not they're armed, and the university won't put metal detectors anywhere. It's not a happy time at KU or anywhere else in the region system.
And that's it seems like just one of the reasons why KU is becoming a harder school to teach at. Another reason seems to be how much resources you get from the state house, and then how those resources get distributed once they get to campus. So we've been following that issue for a while, but maybe you could tell us about how things have been going recently on those fronts.
Yeah. So you know, it's not necessarily, you know, earth-shattering news that there's a de facto war on education in the state of Kansas from Topeka, the state house. And we've seen a decline of around $30 million per year since 2009. And that will impact students to the tune of about $1,000 per student that comes to KU more in tuition. So it's really tough to deal with. But the other thing that we've also seen is that we have an extremely wasteful administration. They've been spending money on a lot of things that really make no sense. They bought a brand new jet, an $8.1 million jet. Oh boy, that's just what we need. And we fly it less than, you know, around 200 hours per year, so the costs are just through the roof. We pay $1 million per year to operate the jet. We're looking at a $350 million stadium, you know, a third of $1 billion in a state with only, you know, 3 million people. Kansas is not a wealthy state. And then we've seen administrations take more and more and more money and give themselves lots of raises. Since 2009, we've seen an explosive growth of the number of administrators on campus who are essentially becoming millionaires on the backs of students and their parents. We now have 135 administrators on KU, on the KU campus, who make on average more than $200K per year. That's more than double the average faculty salary. And our salaries have been going down, down, down. And they essentially have shifted $10 million per year in pay for assistant, associate, and full professors, and they've increased their salary base by $10 million. Imagine if somebody went up to your wallet and said, "Hey, I need a raise, so I'm going to take your money and give it to me." What a great deal! You know, I guess if I could give myself a raise, I would love to give myself a raise. But the dynamic on the KU campus is just it's very unhealthy these days. We have a number of faculty members have. They refer to the current and the past administration as the kleptocratic administrators. Klepto, of course, means to steal. Kratic means by force. But you know, we need somehow to return to sanity. We were very fortunate last night. We heard from Doug Ward and Carl Brewer, two really good Democratic candidates. And they made it very clear that if they get elected, they're going to stop a lot of these wasteful practices going on, and they're going to work to support higher ed as they should. So the support will be from the State House and, you know, with appropriate levels of funding so that students who come from families who can't really afford to go to college can now afford it, or can afford it, hopefully in the future. And we're no longer generating a class of millionaires. What are we doing making millionaire public servants? Wow.
And I think it's important that they spoke about education, and especially higher education in Lawrence. You've been an advocate for, I guess, you could phrase it as what sets the University of Kansas apart from the other schools in Kansas. They're all fine schools, but the University of Kansas is the flagship. And do you want to talk more about that?
Sure. So the University of Kansas, we're very fortunate. We're among the first, not the first, but among the first in the state of Kansas. And we were and still are the only university in the state of Kansas that's a member of the Association of American Universities. So it's an AAU. This mark of having AAU membership puts us in the league of Stanford, Caltech, MIT, Purdue, Cornell, all of the nation's universities that maintain the highest levels of scholarship. And what that manifests itself as is that our graduates can command non-trivial levels of salary once they graduate. So the median income for bachelor's degree holders from the University of Kansas. And the same thing holds for Mizzou. KU and Mizzou are next of kin. It's around $95,000 per year. That is really not bad. If you take a look at the four-year institutions that are not AAU institutions, it's $15K less per year. And that's about if you were to sum up all of the lifetime earnings, that's $750,000 difference. And so having an institution of very high academic standing is critical for a state. Missouri has one, and that's Mizzou, and Kansas has one. That's KU. And they both have another thing in common, which is also quite interesting. In the rankings of pay for faculty, they're both dead last among public institutions. They're tied for last. So they are 11% below the regional average of AAU institutions. They are a full 20% below the national average. And so they're both being raided left and right by other institutions, just stealing their faculty. It will eventually come home to roost, and if I were a parent, I would be alarmed. I'd be over the moon because both are being threatened with loss of AAU membership,
which has happened recently because a very nearby state university in Nebraska lost their membership not long ago.
Absolutely. So the a number of institutions around the country, they're reevaluated every year. And if you keep whittling away at the strength of an institution, which is fundamentally at its core, it's the faculty and the staff. They maintain the strength. And if you cut them year after year after year, and you enrich the administration at the cost of the faculty and the staff, you'll have nothing left. Nobody will wind up working, and it will wind up hurting not simply the students but the alumni as well. So the earning power of the alumni will also be adversely affected. Now, will it be catastrophic? No, it won't be catastrophic, but it will definitely be incremental. There will be less earning power for all of the alumni that will hit.
I think that was a bit of a rallying point for the teachers in West Virginia, was looking comparatively at, you can always say the grass is greener on the other side, but when you have the hard figures that say that you're in last, do you think that can be a rallying point? And do you think that the West Virginia action is maybe helping motivate more people at KU?
Oh, yeah. Well, I certainly hope so. So there's been a lot of information that's been put out across the KU campus. I don't know about Mizzou, but I certainly know KU. And a lot of faculty members are coming to realize that, being last in the AAU is not where we want to be. But a lot of faculty members are taking a line where they're like, okay, well, I don't have to be here, and I'm leaving. So we've lost in our adjacent departments. We've lost distinguished professors of engineering and chemistry and physics. The pay disparity in STEM fields is colossal. We also have another phenomenon that's occurring, and it's called salary compression and salary inversion. And so a lot of faculty members who have served for a long time, they see their salaries getting flatlined or cut year after year. And new assistant professors, to attract them, you have to offer them top dollar. So we have senior professors who have written books, who have done the research, who have brought in millions of dollars. All of a sudden, they're making less than the new faculty members that are just coming in, just out of school. And I can tell you, that just, that adds to no end of troubles. There is trouble in paradise out in Lawrence, that's for sure.
Well, maybe we'll take a break from some of the dismal news coming out of Lawrence for a second. And I realize I neglected to mention the song that we heard at the beginning of the segment, which was Gonna Be an Engineer by Peggy Seeger, which is fitting both because it's International Women's Day and because we're joined by a member of the engineering department at KU. Before the show, you were telling me that there was some good news in relation to the women in engineering in your department, and maybe you could share that with our audience.
Oh, absolutely. So I'm a faculty member in the aerospace engineering department, and many of our finest students that have come through are young ladies and individuals of color. And so our department regularly wins international aerospace design awards. This year we had a first. Our department, students in our department won first place in the world in aircraft design, first place in the world in jet engine design, and simultaneously first place in the world in spacecraft design. It's never happened before in the history of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. And if you take a look at the composition of those teams, they have an overrepresentation of young ladies and people of color, and also people who are not born American. So we have a great deal of diversity. We have more females and more minorities and more minority female design winners than any other institution in the world. So if anybody likes the idea of aerospace design, you know, jets or airplanes or rockets or anything like, man, come to KU. We would love to have you. And I know there are a lot of Missourians that are listening right now. KCMO is my home. Come on out to Lawrence. You know, Missourians can do okay. We'd love to have you there.
Well, that is some good news, and maybe we'll come down to sort of winding up with a bit of talking about what you might foresee for the future, and what it might look like for KU if they are able to stay within the AAU, and if they're not, and what the steps they're going to have to take in order to keep their academic reputation.
Yeah. So. You know, if you take a look, I mean, if I had a magic wand that I could wave, and let's say that a good a responsible steward of the taxpayers' dollar was elected in Topeka and could reshuffle KBOR, I'd love to see a 10% to 20% pay cut for the top 200 administrators on campus. Now you can imagine how popular I'm going to be when I get back to campus. I'll be called into the dean's office, but we need it. There's no reason why public servants are making $1 million. You know, every 3 to 4 years. That's not right. We need a moratorium on non-essential buildings. We need to sell this doggone wasteful chancellor's jet. And we have no business flying around in a luxury jet like that. And we need to return state funding levels to, I'd love to see 2001 state funding levels, where 30% of the KU's budget was floated by the state. Right now it's down to 15%. Just so the families who can't afford higher ed can now afford it. We need that. There are a lot of families that are suffering out there, and we need some relief.
It's much harder to get that access when the state is not providing funding. And I think you mentioned it earlier, but it's worth going over the figures again of how much of this is being put on the backs of students, because it's pretty substantial.
Yeah. No, it's and it's inexcusable. We have $77 million per year we pay for managerial overhead. So those are supervisors all the way from the paint shop to the chancellor. That represents $3,000 per student every year. That is a lot of money for people who have really no role in teaching and no role in scholarly work and research. They're just shuffling papers from one side of the desk to the other. We spend $4,000 per student to pay for the teaching staff. It's absolutely not appropriate to have a ratio like that. At KU, we have 803 administrators, and we have 884 faculty members. We almost have a 1-to-1 ratio. It's not right. It needs to be cut.
Yeah, and it's if it doesn't go that way, then Kansas really could the people, the taxpayers of Kansas are sort of hurting themselves if KU goes in the wrong direction, because, like you said, the highest earning power in the state. Lots of other benefits to having a well-funded public university like KU.
Absolutely. And we saw a group of students who I'd love to put a plug in for, KU Against Rising Tuition. You can find them on Facebook. They are a group of very energetic students. And if we have anybody who's out there who's thinking of going to KU and you're a 6th, 7th, 8th grader, 11th, 12th grader, or even a 2nd grader and you'd love to go to KU, support these young people because they're fighting to keep your tuition low. And if tuition is going up on the order of $1,000 every 3 years, imagine what it's going to be like if your kid's in the 6th grade right now. Heaven help you. So support these young people in KU Against Rising Tuition, and it will pay dividends for you in the future. They're good students, and they're fired up.
The cost of higher education has gotten out of control. In some places, I hear it's over $60,000 a year. So keeping affordable education for for young people in Kansas is definitely very important. Is there any other organizations that you would like to, you know, point out that are doing good work related to the gun issue or any other campus issue that's important to you?
Sure. So the primary group that we work with is the American Association of University Professors. We also help with Moms Demand Action. They're absolutely great. The KU Against Rising Tuition has spearheaded the unbelievable rise of tuition and its many forms. Join or support any and all of them. It'll help.
We've been speaking with Professor Ron Barrett Gonzalez, a Kansas City native, aerospace engineering professor out in Lawrence at the University of Kansas. Ron, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, what a pleasure to be back in my hometown.
All right.
1 year later, the Women's March Revisited. Voices from D.C., New York, Nairobi, Bogota, and more on Wings, Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
KKFI's 30th anniversary celebration will be held June 30th at the Folly Theater. This fundraiser for KKFI will include a VIP reception at 6 p.m., KKFI history presentation and founders panel at 7 p.m. The show starts at 8 with two all-star house bands backing up at least 15 different artists of very different styles. We'll be celebrating the diverse, unique programming of KKFI live on stage at the Folly Theater on June 30th. Hosted by KKFI DJs, so you know we'll have a good time. VIP passes are $90 and reserved seats are as low as $15. Please come and be a part of KKFI's history at the Folly Theater on June 30th. KKFI.org/events for tickets and information. VIP reception, KKFI history, two all-star bands, well over 15 styles of music represented, all hosted by KKFI's programmers. KKFI.org/events to get your tickets today.
Welcome, Pat Dukovich, president of AFL-CIO, to our show this evening.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me, and I'm happy to be here.
Well, you know, you're one of our favorite people because you help. Do you kind of keep in line 57 different 50 labor unions? Do you represent
I have no idea how to keep them in line. Just remember this. I mean, I try to help out as much as I can, but one thing that I have learned is it's extremely difficult to tell if you're leading or being chased because it looks exactly the same.
Well, you've always done a great job for us, and we appreciate it. Tonight, we wanted to speak to Kevin Corlew, brought up, I guess, again, the House bill, is it 1512, having to do with arbitration, and can you explain that? Although they dropped it, he seems to be bringing it up every year or has been for the last few years. Are they trying to wear us down, or exactly what is that?
Okay, so this is one of the continuing attacks on working people here in Missouri, and it's been going on across the country. One of the things that we have to really give credit to the other side is that they have been disciplined and they have a long-term strategy. And so I think that it would probably be easiest to start way back at the birth of this country. And don't worry, I'll move really quickly through history. Mm-hmm. But back when this country started, if you were injured on the job and if your employer was negligent, you could sue your employer and you could go to court and you could win damages against your employer. And so the employers, the bosses decided that they didn't like this system. and they said, hey, look, we're going to create a new system. We're going to call it workers' comp. Now, this is one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that workers' comp was not invented by us. It was the boss's plan to save them money. They said, what we'll do is we will all throw money into a pool, and if you're injured at work, we will pay for your medical treatment out of that pool, and if you're disabled, there'll be a judge you can go see, and if they can determine your disability, we'll pay your disability out of that pool, but you can't sue us. We don't want to be sued anymore. And so that's the system we currently have today. And I, for one, would probably gladly give up the workers' comp system if we'd go back to the way where I could sue you for your bad actions. But that's just not the case.
No.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the other things that is really key to this is that if you have a collective bargaining agreement and you are harmed or wronged, you have to exercise all of the administrative processes in your agreement. You have to file a grievance. You have to go through that entire process all the way to the end, up to and including binding arbitration or whatever's in your agreement, at which point after that, then you can go to the courts and get some kind of justice if you feel you've not been served. And so the employers like having that also because it, again, keeps them out of the very expensive court system. Well, now what we're seeing is that they have decreased the ability of the unions, that they have so damaged workers' comp that now they're seeing that more and more workers, if you don't have a union, you don't have a collective bargaining agreement, you can go straight to court. Well, they want to end that. So they're trying to put arbitration-only clauses in so that they can't be sued where there is no union.
Well, that is a problem, and it makes me think of how a I don't think I have him on the line. Duke, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. Good. I'm sorry, I went to mute.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah.
But I remember working for AT&T that they had changed it to where you could not have carpal tunnel. They changed it to it had to be, you had to pick a specific date where you had your injury, so then that just tossed all those out.
You're exactly right. And so, again, we see continually chipping away at whatever the workers have got. And so they changed the law under Governor Blunt was one of the biggest ones.
Mm-hmm.
And the original proposal was just, I mean, it was horrific. What we ended up with was bad, but what was proposed was horrific. And so let's say you're a bricklayer and you do your job and you build walls with cinder blocks and that's what you do. And you go in there and you've been doing it for 20 years. And so here you are, mid to late 40s. You do your 8-hour shift building the wall and your back hurts. And so you can't go to work the next day because you are just tore up. And so you need what probably 80 to 90% of the people who file a workers' comp claim need, which is just a little bit of medical treatment and a couple of days off and maybe some rehab and you're right back to work. And so that was the system that we had. And when they changed it, they said that you could no longer say that your 8-hour day of moving cinder blocks, of carrying the mortar, of all that caused your back injury. You had to point to the specific individual item that caused your injury. And if they could trick you into doing that and saying that right there is the brick that caused my back to hurt, they would weigh it and say, well, it's no different than any other bricks, and so they would throw your claim out.
Mm-hmm.
They also changed the workers' comp law to say that if you violated a safety rule or did not use a safety device, whether you knew about it or not, then the claim was on you. And so this is all about shifting everything back to the employee. And in this arbitration-only clause, they're literally taking your rights away to be able to seek justice. The proceedings would be secret. They would not be public. They'd be determined by an arbitrator who's probably going to be hired by the company. And it's just, it's bad, and it's bad for working people, and it's one more kind of nail in our coffin.
So it looks like we should probably expect to see this again.
We should. And you know, you never see anybody really take the first shot at the strongest opponent. In organized labor here in the Kansas City area, in the state of Missouri, is still a pretty formidable opponent. And so all we have to do is look at what they've done in the private sector, where they don't have these kind of protections, where you don't see the solidarity and the people standing together, and even the resources sometimes to push back with lawsuits and challenges to the legality of what they're trying to do. Cerner, we all know Cerner, a great big medical record software company. So Cerner had a couple of different lawsuits that had claimed that they had misclassified their workers as managers to avoid paying them overtime. We're all familiar with how that happens. They say you're the manager, so you're salaried. You don't get overtime after 40 hours. A group of Cerner employees thought that they had been misclassified, and they sued, and they sought and got class action status. And so this could turn out to be a very expensive lawsuit for Cerner. So Cerner decided that they were going to stop this. Well, they didn't decide that they were going to stop it by doing the right thing and classifying people right. What they decided to do was go to their employees and to offer them the ability to get a $500 stock option and to participate in a merit pay system increase by signing an agreement where they would agree to arbitration only. If they wouldn't agree to arbitration only, they were still employed, they gave up and forfeited the $500 stock option, and they were excluded from the merit pay increase. So basically what you make is what you make. And we're seeing more and more of these arbitration-only agreements in employment contracts with those who are not represented by a union. And
that is horrible. That's not right. I am just so tired of being attacked in every direction.
Well, and so I got a great idea for you. So I had we had talked about this. There's a great documentary called Hot Coffee. And if you watch that one, and you can get through that. So part of the deal about Hot Coffee is we all know the story of the lady who bought coffee at McDonald's and drove off and spilled it and burned herself and got, make up a number, $3 million.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you know about that story is false. Everything you know is not true. She wasn't driving. She was a passenger. She had burns that required her to have skin grafts. She was in intensive care. The lid didn't fit. They tried to send it back. It was just a terrible problem. She eventually ended up dying. She sued to get her medical bills paid for, and they wouldn't pay for it. I highly recommend, if you can find it, it's out there, watch the documentary called Hot Coffee.
Thank you,
and then
I will.
After that is another one called Terms and Conditions. And so if you sign up for a credit card, if you have a credit card or you have a cell phone or you have anything, at some point you will get a notice in the mail or by email that says the terms and conditions have changed and you no longer have the right to sue us if we do anything wrong or make any mistake or destroy your credit or totally mishandle or there's malfeasance or negligence on our part. You can't sue us. And if you use your credit card or you use your cell phone, you agree to these terms and conditions.
And
they've been doing
agree,
that, putting those in envelopes for years.
And if you don't agree, we cancel your card.
Yeah, exactly. And so what I recommend you do is that you write on the back of your check one time. I know everybody does, but nobody pays by check anymore. But one time, pay by check. And on the back of the check, say, hey, terms and conditions have changed. I now have all of my rights to sue you. And if you cash this check, you agree to these terms and conditions. And trust me, it will go to some kind of service center, probably out of the country, and it will be cashed, and you will at least have a door into the court system. You'll still have a fight, but you'll at least get into the court, because right now with arbitration-only clauses, no matter how horribly you've been treated, you're not even going to get into the courts because you agreed to give up your right to sue anybody. And that's the kind of, this is, again, these are just more and more challenges we face. We all know right to work. We've heard about prevailing wage, but these are the ones that just don't get the airtime.
Well, I appreciate it so much, but I want to allow us some time to talk about the what we're going to be voting on in August, the right to work for less.
Yes, yes. Well, and so we're not exactly sure of what the date is going to be. We think it's going to be in August, and I will give you guys a little bit of kind of the back and forth inside baseball from even the Republican Party and from others. The Republicans have the ability to put it on the ballot. So when do they put it on the ballot? If they put it in August, that'll be a low turnout election, and organized labor should be able to drive a big turnout, because even people who support right to work for less are probably not going to go out and vote. So there's a good chance we can win if it's in August because of the voter turnout. There's a good chance we can win regardless, but we get a little bit of a bump in August. And so do they hold off and they do it in November? Well, if they do it in November and we're able to turn out, then Claire McCaskill gets a bump, all of the midterm candidates get a bump, and we win again. So with this kind of backlash we're seeing, is that a good time to have it? So that's the discussions right now. Right now, I was 99% sure it was going to be in August. Right now, I'm giving it about 90% sure, but we'll see as it continues to go. We need to be ready. The other thing is that the Republican Party and the leaders of this movement could have it tomorrow, and they could have $4 million and be up on TV tonight, and we know we can't do that and compete. So there is a kind of catch us off guard, but I'm not sure that's going to work. But right to work is crucial. This is the first chance we've got to stand up, smack back, and actually make changes and let people know that they care. It polls well. We tripled the number of signatures required. We set a record in the state of Missouri. This should be one where we follow through and finish this.
But this is for not only labor, this is for all working people, because don't we set the standard with that?
Yeah, without a doubt, we set the standard for them. And I can tell you right now, I started to do this, and I was not able to make any actual presentation out of it, and I kind of gave up. I started messing around with it, and then I got taken off into other directions. But do this. Look at the states that have the highest infant mortality rates. Look at the states that have the lowest literacy rates. Look at the states that have the lowest standards of living. Pick whatever you don't like and look at those states and then see which ones of them are right to work states. And there are not a lot of top tier states that have right to work. And all the arguments about right to work, I mean, Harley Davidson just announced they're leaving Kansas City, Missouri, which arguably we just passed right to work, to go to York, Pennsylvania, which is not a right to work state.
That's true. I think a lot of people don't know who's driving this. Could you tell them real quickly who is pushing this? Because I just couldn't figure out why do they care.
Well, here locally, I can tell you some people that we know are pushing this, and so we know without a doubt. And this is the part that really pains me, but I'm not willing to really pull punches. I mean, the easy ones are, you know, of course, Rex Singfield, who has passed all kinds of stuff to try to take away Kansas City's earnings tax, to try to get rid of all of the rights that we have here in Kansas City. This is from when a billionaire from out of town comes to try to tell you what to do, you should really question their motives. But Rex Singfield, without a doubt. The Humphreys brother, Tamco Roofing in Joplin, Missouri, they are behind this. They're pushing 100%. They absolutely do not like that you can sue them because their shingles are inferior, and so they are moving to get rid of some of the product safety regulations and a lot of the consumer protection laws that are out there, but also they don't want to be organized. They don't want this. They're pushing really, really hard on right to work. We have got Herzog Construction up in St. Joe, which built our lovely streetcar here in Kansas City, who are some good people, but they write checks to Governor Greitens, who continues to kick us in the butt and hurt us bad. And so Gary Crosley Ford has written checks to the wrong side. Belfonte has written checks to the wrong side. And so I just don't see any grassroots community people, any people who are trying to make lives better in Kansas City supporting this agenda.
But the reason they do that is because they're paying back the legislative people, they're paying back for getting donations. I guess there was Holly got $10,000 for putting that up, bringing that.
Well, and listen, money to them is nothing. And that's the first thing that I think that I think that one of the things that to understand where they're at and the logic is that, you know, I had a discussion with somebody back when Rex Singfield was trying to end the earnings tax here in Kansas City. And I talked to a friend of mine who lives in St. Louis, who's a really, really smart, connected guy. He's just not political. He doesn't live in this world, and so he doesn't see anything as D's and R's and elections coming up. And so I said, yeah, you know, your buddy Rex Singfield. And he said, well, you know, Rex is a good guy. He likes to portray himself as this, you know, grandfatherly philanthropist who's trying to do the right thing, and he's into the arts and all of this. And I said, well, he's thrown $3 million into this to try to eliminate Kansas City's earnings tax, which supports a lot of the things we need. And he said, oh, no. He said, when he hits $11 million, that's when you know Rex is serious. $3 million, that's nothing to this guy. I mean, that's literally like going to a nice lunch for him. So the amount of money they have to throw around and to try to continue to do this to get more money is staggering.
Well, that's very upsetting. And we have about 1 minute. Do you have any action for us to take, or do you just want us to wait until you have more information, then come back again?
No. Please go research this stuff. Read everything you can and see what's going on. I mean, we've got some great friends. We're going to be sending out some more stuff. You know, John Boyd of Boyd & Kettner Law Firm has graciously written some articles explaining some of this complicated legal issues to our people. We're going to continue to push those out and get those out. Stay tuned. Vote no on Prop A. This is very, very critical. Our side, right to work, we need to vote no on Prop A. And that's going to be it. Proposition A, vote no.
Well, that's how we will go out tonight then, is vote no on Prop A.
That's it. Thank you so much for letting me talk tonight.
Thanks very much, Duke, for coming. Bye-bye.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Good evening, and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel. This time, I take you back to a very recent struggle, one that ended in victory this week and may be spreading to a state near us. Teachers in West Virginia went on strike on February 22, 2018. When they won 9 days later, they won a 5% pay increase for all state workers, not just themselves. They achieved this by coordinating the strike between three unions and in all 55 county-wide school districts in the state. When ordered by their state union leaders to return to work, they refused, and their victory came due to what then became a wildcat strike. A wildcat strike is a strike that is not sanctioned by union leadership. These teachers suspended their state's entire school system for over a week, and still public support for the teachers remained high. This is in part because teacher pay in West Virginia is 48th lowest in the nation. Many of the striking teachers are the descendants of union coal miners. Labor militancy is a bit of a state tradition in West Virginia, from the railroad strike in 1877 to the Battle of Blair Mountain of the coal miners. West Virginia miners themselves engaged in wildcat strikes well into the 1970s. Teachers in West Virginia went on strike 28 years ago as well, winning a pay raise as well as training and support programs and the establishment of faculty senates. Teachers in Oklahoma may soon be following their lead. Oklahoma ranks 49th on educational investment. Teachers in Oklahoma have taken to the internet to organize, and through online petitions and social media, they are discussing a strike. They also walked out in 1990, winning increased pay, the establishment of class size limits, and the expansion of the kindergarten program. Oklahoma teachers have discussed striking as early as the week following spring break, which is 1 week before the April 2nd standardized tests. News OK, a local news agency, reported that nearly 80% of respondents to an online survey administered by the Oklahoma Educators Association voiced support for school closures to force lawmakers to increase educational investments. Teachers in Arizona are also discussing a strike. They are the unlucky state to rank 50th in educational investments. Thousands of Arizona teachers, as well as students and supporters, wore red on Wednesday, March 7th in an internet-spawned movement called #RedForEd. State union leadership declined to endorse or rule out a strike, instead calling for legislative solutions. 1,400 West Virginia CWA members working for Frontier Communications also went on strike March 4th after months of contract negotiations and being emboldened by their striking teacher neighbors. One can hope that many more people will find inspiration in West Virginia educators' example of how to win a labor victory in 2018. Stuart Acuff, a union member of Martinsburg, West Virginia, poetically expressed hope for long-term effects even deeper than the teachers' contractual victories. Will the history teachers teach the history they make today? Will the English teachers teach the literature of handmade strike signs? And will coaches teach players of the teachers' will to win and determination to defeat injustice? Will we in West Virginia teach America again of the divinity of collective commitment to the common good? The battle being waged in West Virginia is a real reminder of what made America great. Not the obsequious, offensive pandering to the plutocrats, GOP politicians determined to demean and diminish our educators, to suck the breasts of plutocrats to pad their pockets, render themselves unfit in their injustice to lead a proud people. Have a good evening.
The Heartland Forum calendar on March 8, 2018. To find our calendar on the web, go to heartlandlaborforum.org. Celebrate International Women's Day today, March 8th, 7:30 p.m. at the UMKC Student Union, 52nd and Cherry, room 402. Poetry, History, and Urban Studies. Find out about the history of working women and their contributions. Dolores the Movie, Saturday, March 10th, Kansas City, Kansas, Community College, at the Flint Building, 3632, Kansas City, Kansas Public Library, Plaza Branch. This new documentary by Independent Lens about the life of United Farm Workers leader Dolores Huerta. All Souls Forum, Undocumented Lives, a panel discussion. Sunday, March 11th at 10 a.m. at All Souls UU Church at 4501 Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri. March for Our Lives, Kansas City. Saturday, March 24th, noon to 4 at Thais Park? Anyway, it's at 533 Emmanuel Cleaver 2 Boulevard in Kansas City, Missouri. Enough. Weapons are not more important than people. And you can reach them by Facebook.com, events 968-235-1066-01171. The Poor People's Campaign Faith Assembly, Saturday, March 24th at 3 to 5, Community Christian Church at 4601 Main, Kansas City, Missouri. Missouri Labor Mobilization in Jefferson City, Wednesday, March 28th, 10 to 11:30 a.m. Rally will be at noon at the Missouri State Capitol. Labor Notes has opened registration for its 2018 Troublemakers Conference, April 6th to 8th in Chicago. For early bird rates, go to labornotes.org/conference. Check out the Heartland Labor Forum schedule on the web at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also listen to today's show. Like us on Facebook, just search for Heartland Labor Forum. Send us your feedback about the show. What do you want to hear? What did you like or hate? Volunteer for the Heartland Labor Forum. Call us at 816-235-1470.
Thanks so much to Hester. And Hester was kind enough to do that last segment with Duke from the AFL-CIO. So that was really awesome. Great segment. Okay. So that is the end of tonight's show. Judy has had to leave to do a presentation. So I'm Jen Zaman, and I am doing the underwriting. Next week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll discuss, will Missouri gut prevailing wage laws and Class War USA, dispatches from workers' struggles in American history. Once again, I've been your engineer and your host, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.